Flutist and conductor Ransom Wilson is nearing the end of his second season as music director of the Redland Symphony Orchestra. Our shared interest in the music of William Grant Still is what brought us together. It was the impetus for our conversation, and I wanted to discuss, among other things, his philosophy for coming up with programs for the orchestra concerts. Ransom Wilson.
Maybe because I've come from the flute world where we have to be creative about programming, because we don't have three Brahms sonatas or 32 Beethoven sonatas. We have to be creative, and so I look at most orchestral programming, let's say major orchestras, and this is not a condemnation at all, but I will look at, you know, say Boston Symphony or something programs, and think, what were they thinking putting these pieces together? I mean, a Mozart overture, a Brahms concerto, and a Schumann symphony. I mean, yes, of course, there's a Germanic connection, but was there really any thought that went into this? Or often there will be a big French piece followed by a German symphony, and it just seems so random. And also, I feel like there are just far too many masterpieces on each program. Mm-hmm. I look at it like a meal. I feel like, that's going to be like eating a big holiday meal, and you're going to feel awful afterwards. Just because you're just too much stimulation.
Yeah.
So I like, and again, this is probably because I'm a flute player. I find that the B composers, and even sometimes the C composers, B list and the C list, have their place. And that we really understand a masterpiece and why a masterpiece is a masterpiece if it's next to something that is a little bit less, lesser breasted bird, if you will. And I feel like you understand both composers better in that situation rather than putting, Schumann and Brahms next to each other, where you're going to be overloaded with information. And that's just how I feel, even as a concert goer. This is also very true of the young generation that I work with. They tend to have great variety in their programming. Even look at any young string quartet. They have I went to a string quartet concert the other night. And part of their program was an arrangement they had done themselves of some video game music. And it was perfectly acceptable, and they were proud of it, and the audience loved it. And so that kind of variety, and I'm kind of looking for that kind of variety in programming. And I like thematic programming, but I don't want it to be as generic as, A Journey Down the Rhine or whatever.
Yeah.
I want it to have some really important historical reason, music of conflict, the Holocaust, whatever, something that really makes people understand something. So they leave the concert hall, they've actually learned something and experienced something. And to me, that's what I'm after. So I guess I'm interested in the musical aspect and the extra musical aspect.
Yeah.
So when I was going to do a program, I knew that I was going to do the Ravel G Major Concerto and Rhapsody in Blue with this amazing French pianist, François Dumont, that I've worked with now a lot. And so I built a program around that. So, well, we've got Paris, but it's jazz, Paris with a jazz influence, and we've got American with a jazz influence. So what else fills out that program? And immediately I started thinking about William Grant Still. About whom I really, I knew about him, but I really heard very little of his music at that point, because there are very few opportunities to hear it live. For some reason, he's been passed over. I think it's just latent racism in our culture that accounts for that. But there's so much great music there that it astonishes me that it's not regularly on programs of major orchestras. So I thought, well, you know, this is a terrible injustice, and I announced to the audience when we did, when we did that that piece last fall. I announced to the audience. I said this piece was premiered the same year as Rhapsody in Blue, and yet it was given no attention at all. And it, you know, it was a similar situation, kind of jazz brought into the concert hall, which was kind of a shocking thing for a lot of people. And, you know, whereas Gershwin was lauded for it and historically famous for it now, William Grant Still was virtually ignored for it. And I think it was, you know, I think it was a racial issue.
Yes.
So I said to the audience in Redlands, I think this is a terrible injustice, and I want to do something about it. So I'm going to be programming, you know, some William Grant Still over the years. So I just wanted to let you know. And everybody applauded. It wasn't my intention. I was just telling them, you know, to kind of forewarn them. There's a reason why you're going to see this name come up, you know, fairly often.
Yeah.
So that's what got his daughter's attention.
Today, I suppose, we've moved on and ignored it for so many years that it's just sort of the way we've done things, and you have to kind of go out of the way to break loose of ignoring all these great pieces of music, whether it's by an African-American composer or anyone else's wonderful music that's been buried for years.
Yeah, and I'm excited to rediscover things that that are great, but that for whatever reason never made it into the mainstream.
Yeah,
and I'm excited by that, and I have nothing against Schumann or Mendelssohn or Beethoven or Brahms, and I program them very frequently, as everyone does. But I'm also excited by the undiscovered.
Mm-hmm. And there has to be a way, that's what you're planning to do. There has to be a way to present these things as along with everything else. Not just to say, okay, today we're going to have tonight it's a program of all African-American composers, or this is African-American month. And so this month we'll hear a lot of it.
Yeah, that's just ghettoizing it, uh-huh. Yes, it helps showcase the music in a certain way, but it doesn't really solve the problem, which is why has this music been kept apart?
Yes, and that's
so, yeah. I'm trying to integrate it into a normal program so that it's just seen alongside all the other great pieces. There's a lot to be done. There's a lot of work to be done kind of changing the way orchestras present music. I mean, I don't think that in major cities the orchestras are going to die, but even now, I mean, I went to hear the Montreal Symphony the other night, and I was astonished. The program ended with Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, but it started with the Rachmaninoff Trio for violin, cello, and piano. I mean, that's 10 years ago. That would have been seen as sacrilege on a program for a major orchestra. Uh-huh. To start with a trio. I kept asking people, "Did I understand you right? They're starting with a trio because it seems so unusual to me." It's the kind of thing we do in Redlands. Like, we just keep varying the size of the orchestra, but most major orchestras are just not willing to do that. But I think, you know, I think anything we can do as musicians to make our programming more interesting to the audience is what we should be doing, because as you say, it's a challenge to keep people coming to the concert hall. The number of distractions that we have in our lives now is exponentially more than when I was growing up, for example.
Yeah. And the technological changes that have occurred, have affected what people do, how people listen to music, and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and so I'm all for anything that we can do. And I've always said, programming drives everything. And if we've got our audience, our population is, first of all, becoming much more diverse. Even in small towns in America now, you have a lot of people from South and Central America, Mexico, a lot of people from India, Pakistan, and the Philippines, and all of this has changed kind of the nature of society, and yet orchestral programming has not generally responded to any of that diversity. And I think that's a big mistake. I think if we want to be a part of, if we want to be a part of the cultural landscape of the society that we live in, then we have to respond to where our population is, consists of all these different kinds of languages, food, literature. Why isn't that reflected in concerts as well? So that's part of my thinking.
Yeah, it's a good thing. The change in population, the people from different places, the different cultures, but the music world, I suppose, has to change with it.
Well, that's my feeling, that we have a duty to change with it, to reflect our the people that we serve. But it's not a popular point of view in my business,
yeah.
Except among the next generation, the young people, people in their early 20s, and they are the salvation of concerts. I think they're saving it now and in ways that they don't even realize, just by reaching out, by being forced to reach out, and by being forced to be creative with programming and presentation. They are right now creating their audience.
Yeah, and these are changes that, by definition, are not things that can be changed overnight by just saying, okay, we're not going to do things that way anymore. Tomorrow we'll start doing this. It is a generational kind of change over time.
Yes. I'm in my second year in Redlands, and I've tried to change a lot of things, but changing them quickly is never popular.
Yeah.
So I'm learning to take baby steps.
Yeah, I think you're heading out there for a concert, what is this, the Mendelssohn concert?
It is, and we're doing the Italian Symphony, but we're doing it in most musicians don't even know this. The Italian Symphony, which for us musicians and audience alike is one of the great masterpieces of Western music, and yet Mendelssohn heard it and hated it and wouldn't allow it to be published in his lifetime, and he immediately started revising it, and the following year, 1834, he completed a new manuscript for the Italian Symphony, minus the first movement. He said the first movement was such a disaster, he would just have to replace the whole thing. So he never touched the first movement. But second, third, and fourth movement of this iconic symphony are vastly changed in his 1834 revision. And somehow, after his death, only the original version got published. And this other one's kind of ended up in in various libraries around the world. And an American musicologist just made it his task, because he had read in the letters about these revisions, but nobody really looked at the music. So he got it and published it. And so that's the version we're doing.
Uh-huh.
We're doing this wild version that nobody knows. It actually is recorded. John Elliott Gardner recorded it with Vienna. And it's so available. I found it on Spotify the other day. And it's on YouTube as well. But I'm sure you know the Italian Symphony very
yes.
well.
Yes.
Listen to this. It will blow your mind. It's, I can't say that it's better. It's certainly very different. And some of the choices that he made are really surprising. Some of the things that he took out, things that that were originally in major are now minor, and vice versa. I'm not sure that we'll ever be able to evaluate it objectively, because we know the other version so well.
Yeah.
But people have asked me, well, is it better? And I don't think so, but I could be wrong. You know, certainly every bar of it is gorgeous Mendelssohn, and that's a great thing. But it's going to be difficult, I think, for the musicians, whose fingers are going to just go automatically where they are used to going in the Italian Symphony.
Oh yeah.
And they're going to have to learn new things. I mean, it's very hard for me to study it as a conductor, because I know I think the Italian Symphony in its normal version I could easily do without the score, but this one it just keeps throwing me curves, because things will happen three times that only happen once in the original.
Yes.
Stuff like that. It's fascinating. And for me, it's fascinating just because it gives us a window into the mind of this genius composer. But, you know, things that we accept as masterpiece, he didn't think were very good, and decided he needed to replace them. And what he decided wasn't good, and what he decided was a better replacement, is a fascinating thing to see.
And may not be obvious to us today, because he made that decision based on another time, I suppose. He really heard it inside was not the first version. He really honed it down next year.
Yeah, it's his basic comments were that he felt like the version that we know was filled with immaturity. Like, it all sounded like it was written by a young composer. I mean, my God, he was only 25. But considering that, you know, some of his greatest pieces were written when he was 16, I guess he felt very old at that point. But, it's just fascinating and curious that there's a whole other version of this most famous piece by Mendelssohn that nobody knows. So I thought we had to do it, you know.
Yeah, you had to have said to the orchestra something before you dug into the rehearsal, to the effect of, or is this going to be rehearsal week? And preface
it. Rehearsal week.
Yeah, so prefacing it with forget everything you know about the Italian
exactly.
Symphony.
Yeah, I already emailed them and said, you know, take care. This is not what you think it is. Yes, it's still Symphony Number 4, but it's so different that you really need to look at these parts before the first rehearsal. So I think everybody's ready.